If you ache for truth, goodness, and beauty, if you're hungry for a Christianity with substance and strength, if you long for a faith that's big and bold and biblical and all about Jesus Christ, if you're inspired by the idea of one church that has spanned 20 centuries, 24 time zones, and two hemispheres, enfolding every race, nation, and language, then you're considering Catholicism.
One of the most beloved of Catholic prayers comes down to us from the monasteries of France in the Middle Ages. In Latin, it was the Salve Regina. In English, the Hail Holy Queen. I bring it up because a few of its lines poetically capture what happened next in the story the scriptures tell. To thee do we cry, poor banished children of Eve. To thee do we send up our sighs, mourning and weeping in this valley of tears. Turn then, most gracious advocate, thine eyes of mercy toward us, and after this, our exile, show unto us the blessed fruit of thy womb, Jesus. And that is exactly who we are. Poor banished children of Eve, exiled to this valley of tears, we sigh for the paradise that we have lost. Over the centuries, sermons, short stories, plays, and paintings have all tried to capture the mourning after Adam and Eve's exile. But can you imagine that first night? The awful pain and sense of remorse? Did they plead with God to give them a second chance as they huddled in the dark, cold despite their new animal skin clothes? Did they stare in fear at the edge of their firelight, hearing noises in the dark and the howl of wolves on the hills? Even diminished by sin, they must have retained their great intellect and skills, their gifts to invent and work as images of God. But now it's difficult. Everything is more difficult. And they feel heat and cold, pain and exhaustion. They get calluses. They get hungry and sick. They develop arthritis from manual labor. Sometimes the hunting is scarce. Sometimes the fruit on the trees gets wormy. Sometimes the wheat and the vegetables get pummeled by hailstones. And always, there is a shared sadness. They remember Eden. They remember their innocence. They remember their conversations with God when he visited them in the garden during the cool of the day. They remember the serpent's lies, how they let themselves be deceived. They remember the moment that their eyes were opened and they saw what they had become. They remember hiding in the bushes. They remember their shame. And they remember God's judgments and pronouncements for their future. In their banishment, they sigh. The first three sentences of Genesis chapter 4 propel the story forward. Adam made love to his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man." Later, she gave birth to his brother, Abel. In Hebrew, Cain's name sounds like the word brought forth or gotten or acquired. Eve says, "I have kanad a man, and his name is Cain." The similarity of these two words stresses that the first birth, the first child, has been received from God from her body. Remember, as images of God, it is the nature of humans to bring forth life. That's what Eve's name means. And then she does it again, and this son is named Abel. Of course, these boys never knew Eden. Did they ever get tired of hearing mom and dad talk about it all the time? Did mom and dad talk about it all the time? I mean, they must have told the boys something about God, because what happens next shows that the kids worshiped him, but with different degrees of understanding and obedience. The story continues. Now Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. So, Abel is a shepherd, and Cain is a farmer. It's not an accident that Abel is a shepherd. The whole Old Testament is foreshadowing what is to come. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob will be shepherds. Moses will be a shepherd. David will be a shepherd, and they all foreshadow the Good Shepherd, their descendant Jesus. The story continues. In the course of time, Cain brought forth some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. And Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. So Cain took some of what he'd grown and brought it to an altar. Now, it doesn't say there was an altar, but it's implied because that's what you do with an offering. Now, maybe he put some grains, some vegetables, some fruit in a basket and laid it on the altar. He gave back to God from what he had produced with his labor. Now, that sounds like a fine and beautiful gesture, a wonderful sacrifice. And Abel did the same. He slaughtered a few of his firstborn sheep and brought the fat portions. In the Old Testament, this was the best portion, the prescribed sacrifice. So, both boys did the right thing, right? Well, then we read about God's reaction. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. Why? What was wrong with Cain's offering? I mean, he gave to God the best of what he had. Isn't that what we're supposed to do? Is God ungrateful here? But here's the problem. The fruit basket was beautiful, but God didn't ask for a fruit basket. How do we know what God asked for? Well, we read parts of the Old Testament in context with other parts of the Old Testament. Now, just a few chapters ahead in Genesis, we'll read that the correct sacrifice to God is an animal sacrifice. In the next book, Exodus, God will explicitly prescribe animal sacrifice. And if you remember the end of our last episode, God foreshadowed animal sacrifice as the way to cover sin. That's why he gave them animal skin clothes. Now, we don't know what Adam and Eve taught the boys, but we can be pretty sure that they were taught that the offering for sin is blood sacrifice. Now, whether we, as 21st century Christians, like it or not, the whole point of the sacrificial system was atonement and substitutionary death. And the whole point of that was to foreshadow the ultimate sacrifice in Christ. The issue wasn't that the fruit basket wasn't nice. I'm sure it was a lovely fruit basket. And maybe it seemed like a nice gesture, but it was really a passive-aggressive gift. Cain knew what God wanted, and Cain brought him something else instead. And here's something else about that. Cain was the farmer, Abel was the shepherd. Where was Cain supposed to get the sacrificial lamb? He'd have to get it from his brother. He'd have to ask him a favor to trade with him, whatever. And that required this proud elder brother to go to depend upon, to need his younger brother. And everything we read about Cain gives us the sense that he did not want to have to do that, that he resented having to do that. And so he pouts, he steams, he quietly rebels. He will not go to that kid and ask him for anything. So he prepares the fruit basket, sticks it on the altar, saying in effect, "Here, God, take this." And God, as the text reads, did not look with favor on this offering. We see Cain's character revealed in his reaction to God's reaction. Now, Cain could have said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, God. I thought you would be pleased. I worked hard to produce that fruit, and I thought you would appreciate the fruit basket. I'll be right back. Let me just go run to my brother and get a lamb." But that's not what Cain does. We read, "So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast." When your face is cast down, you're avoiding looking up at God. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it." God sees what's in Cain's heart. He sees the resentment that kept him from getting a lamb from his brother in the first place. God sees the passive-aggressive gift for what it is. He sees the bitter reaction. He sees the downcast face, avoiding looking God in the eye, so to speak. God is warning Cain, if you willfully turn aside from doing the right thing, sin, with all of its dangers and painful consequences, is right there at your doorstep. It desires to have you. God tells him, and us, you must rule over it. The church fathers told us that we are gifted with intellect and will. We have the ability and the responsibility to recognize right and wrong and to choose and act accordingly. We must develop the discipline to master our passions. But that is not what Cain does. In two sentences, we see the opening act of the whole sorry story of human conflict. All of the hatred and scheming and deceit and violence and blood spread out before us. Now Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let us go out into the field." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Humanity's first death wasn't from old age or even disease. It wasn't in bed with loved ones looking on. A woolly mammoth didn't step on a hunter-gatherer who zigged when he should have zagged. No, the first human death was a murder, a premeditated murder of a brother in a small and intimate family. And over what? What exactly did Abel do to Cain? Cain resented him. Cain was jealous of Abel. Cain was arrogant and angry and hated that his brother made him look bad. So he lured him out into the fields under false pretenses and, I don't know, bashed him with a rock or something. Abel's last thought must have been, "Why?" This is who we are. It's our race's legacy. If we do not master sin, it will master us. And it has left behind a trail of bodies since the first generation born outside of Eden. Abel's murder is significant for another reason. As I keep saying, everything in the Old Testament is a foreshadowing of Christ. We've already seen that Abel foreshadows Christ as a shepherd. Now we see that this innocent and godly shepherd has been slain, as the good shepherd will be slain, not for anything that he did, but by evil men who resent him to avoid giving to God what he asks of them. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" Like he did with Cain's parents when they hid in the shrubbery to avoid him, God gives Cain the chance to tell the truth, to confess, to come clean. At least Adam and Eve offered lame excuses. But Cain gave up on the truth before he even murdered his brother. This is the second lie he's told in three sentences. He lied to Abel to set him up. The lying is interesting, because in just the last chapter we saw that the serpent's lies destroyed his parents' lives. The venom of the father of lies lives on in the next generation. And his response is curious. "Am I my brother's keeper?" As the story is told at this point, there are only four people in the whole world. The correct answer is, well, yes, you are your brother's keeper. Cain also sins by rejecting family, charity, fellowship, and community. And he spits it back into God's face sarcastically. Cain was crooked, broken inside, before he became a murderer. Perhaps that's why he wouldn't offer God the appropriate sacrifice. "Take this fruit basket, God." The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear. Today you are driving me from the land, and I will be hidden from your presence. I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." Throughout history, one of the worst punishments anyone could receive is to be exiled. Now, our postmodern individualist culture is disordered. It likes the idea of having no human bonds or attachments. But nothing was more horrifying than to be adrift, lost in the world without a community, without an identity. Adam and Eve are exiled from Eden, and their eldest son is exiled from them. Their youngest son has returned to the earth, from which Adam himself was taken. But the Lord said to him, "Not so. Anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over." Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Now, at this point, everyone listening is wondering, who is Cain going to run into? I mean, there were only four people on the planet. Now there are three. Well, the Bible doesn't say, but the most obvious and I think implied answer is that Adam and Eve lived a very long time and they had dozens of children who each had dozens of children. And over time, the human community spread. Cain was a grizzled, old, exiled wanderer. But as the human community spread, it disintegrated as well, and some formed clans, rival clans. In fact, we read that after some time, Cain made love to his wife, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. Cain was then building a city, and he named it after his son, Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad was the father of Mehujael, and Mehujael was the father of Methushael, and Methushael was the father of Lamech. Now, when we read city, we need not imagine millions of residents and skyscrapers. At some point, a settlement became a village, which became a town. And maybe it fought with its rivals, and so walls went up around the town. And over the five generations mentioned in just the last two sentences, it became a city. In the next chapter, we read that the first generations after Adam and Eve had long lives. But even if we imagine modern generations of only 20 or 30 years or so, cities spring up in 150 years. Have you ever seen old photos of Los Angeles in the mid-1800s? Five generations later, Cain's descendants are building cities, they're making art, and they're forging tools. But the violence still remains. Near the end of Genesis chapter 4, his descendant Lamech boasts of getting vengeance by murdering a man who offended him, just like his ancestor Cain. Chapter 4 ends with a hopeful note. After describing the generations of Cain, the story winds back to tell of another son that Adam and Eve have had to replace Abel. Of course, they had many children, but this one, Seth, is special. He follows in Abel's footsteps by being a godly man. In fact, as we'll see in our next episode, the line of Seth becomes the only descendants of Adam and Eve that preserve the memory and the worship of the Lord.